This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest, actor, director, and screenwriter Billy Bob Thornton, stars in the new film Friday Night Lights, based on H.G. Bissinger's bestseller about a high school football team in the West Texas city of Odessa. Thornton plays coach Gary Gaines, who leads more with inspiration than intimidation. He's soft-spoken and offended by the cursing and racial epithets which are common around town. But he carries the heavy burden of Odessa's expectations for its legendary Permian Panthers. Here's a clip from the film. It's mid-season, the team is struggling, and the coach is being second-guessed. Thornton, playing Coach Miles, runs into a couple of the team's boosters in a shopping center parking lot.
Hey, Coach.
How you doing?
How you doing?
Ben, how you doing?
All right, Coach, you?
Everything all right?
Well, yeah. Everything's going to be just fine. Everything's all right as long as we get out there and get what we need to get done and, you know, win state.
Well, I sure hope so.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I want it as bad as y'all do, believe me.
Yes, sir.
Of course, you know, Dallas Carter, that's a tough team. Real tough team.
Yeah. Well, we're a pretty tough team too, Coach.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, so, beat them.
Billy Bob Thornton is probably best known for the 1996 film Sling Blade, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. He also co-wrote and starred in One False Move, received an Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in A Simple Plan, directed All the Pretty Horses, and co-wrote The Gift. Thornton played a hard-nosed political consultant in Primary Colors and received the Best Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his role in three films, The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monsters Ball. Terry spoke with Billy Bob Thornton in 2002.
Would you describe the town where you grew up?
Yeah, well, I grew up in two towns. Until I was 8 years old, I lived in a town called Alpine, Arkansas, which is out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the woods. There's not really a town. It's just kind of this valley between all these mountains. And we were sort of the only literate people there. My grandmother had been a school teacher in the old days, you know, like the one-room schoolhouse thing. And my father was going to college on the GI Bill. He'd been in the Korean War. So we lived with my grandmother until I was, like I said, about eight years old or 9 years old. And my grandfather was a retired forestry worker, and he killed what we ate, pretty much, you know. Mm-hmm. Squirrel, possum, raccoon, you know, he would make turtle soup, all kind of stuff. We had no electricity, no running water, we had coal oil lamps, all that kind of thing. And my friends in California usually don't believe that. I mean, they think that that's only from the 1800s or something, you know, kids who are raised in Los Angeles, they just don't get that whole deal.
How old were you when you got electricity?
Well, when we moved into this other town of like 9 or 10,000 people, when I was in the third grade, that's when things started to. To us, it was like we'd moved to New York or something, you know.
So when you moved into this other town, you had electricity, running water.
Oh yeah.
How about television, radio?
You know, I think my grandmother got electricity when I was more like 5 or 6, when we still lived there, she got the electricity, and actually got an old black and white television set. And the reason I remember that so clearly is because she was mopping the floor, and it was a metal television set. And somehow she touched the TV standing in the water, and I don't think she was wearing any shoes, and it really got her pretty good. I remember that. It was kind of like Frankenstein, you know, electricity bad or something like that, you know. But anyway, when we moved into this town, it was called Malvern, Arkansas, which is about 20 miles from Hot Springs, which is where Clinton was from and everything, or where he went to school. And it was like all of those towns. There are all these towns that are about that size, you know, and I guess in every state, you know, and you know, the football team is a big deal. You know, there's a country club where all the doctors and lawyers go. And, you know, it's one of those kind of towns.
What about the movie theaters? Were there movie theaters?
One movie theater. It was called the Ritz Theater, which, you know, my movies now play at, which is very strange when I go home and visit and see something. When I saw Sling Blade on the marquee, it was very strange.
Is it a multiplex now, or is it, you know, did they twin it at least?
Yeah, I think there's like two of them now. It's not like it was. I haven't been in it, actually. It's weird when I go home. I want to go home, and yet there are things there that give me such flashbacks that it's kind of tough, you know.
Did you have a place to buy records when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, there was one record shop also. I mean, now, you know, everything's moved out of town. Main Street's a ghost town, uh-huh. You know, and you know, there's like the Walmart and all the big shopping centers on the outskirts of town. But, I mean, I loved the record shop. It was called Paula's Record Shop. It was run by an older lady. She was one of those people that when I would go back home, I would see her, and it's kind of like, you know, like how Dick Clark is always young. They're also those. Yeah. They're also those people who are always old.
Absolutely.
It's like she was old when I was like five.
Absolutely.
And then when I was like 35, she was exactly the same person, you know. And so it was like a music store and a record shop, and like she sold tambourines, and she had like one drum set, and she would have two or three guitars, you know, in there. And I wanted nothing more in the world than to be the Beatles, you know. I mean, that's what I wanted to be, and or the Dave Clark Five or whatever. And I had little bands from the time I was like 9 years old. And so Paula's Record Shop was, you know, like going to Oz for me. It was just fantastic. And the first record I bought in there with my own money, I went in and bought I Want to Hold Your Hand, which the B-side was I Saw Her Standing There.
A good choice.
Oh, yeah, I love that song.
My guess is Billy Bob Thornton. Now, your mother is a psychic, and that apparently was the inspiration for your movie, The Gift. You wrote the screenplay. It starred Cate Blanchett as a mother and psychic who investigates a murder in her town that hits very close to home. What kind of abilities did your mother have, or does she have?
When I was growing up, you know, we got a lot of flack. I think it's in the movie, actually, you know, about the kids getting a bunch of guff at school for it. People would call my mother a witch and things like that. And then a lot of people would just dismiss it. But at the same time, everybody in town would come to see my mother, but they didn't necessarily want anybody to know that. So they would, I mean, especially men, they would see her in secret, you know, wouldn't want anybody to know that they did something as crazy or sissy-like as to go to a psychic. I mean, it was a very sort of redneck, male-oriented kind of society that I grew up in. But the thing about ESP, which is what my mother has, is it's not the way people think. You don't go to her and say, "Hey, am I going to meet a tall, handsome stranger?" And she says, "Yes, and it's going to be in October." You go and you talk to her. In other words, she feels things about people. She has instincts about people, and she will tell you when she gets around to it. But you can't just ask her a question and say, "Hey, is this thing going to happen?" She may not have that information for you, but she may have something else for you. Like, she'll be talking to you, and she'll say, "So, have you been thinking about buying a new car?" And you'll say, "No, I don't think so. Not really." And then you'll say, "So anyway, what about this big business deal? You think it's going to come through?" And she'll say, "Well, you know, it could. It definitely could. You're sure you're not thinking about buying a new car?" "Well, no, I haven't been." And then 2 days later, somebody calls this person up and says, "Hey, listen, I got this great GTO for sale, you know?" And they buy this car. I mean, it happens that way,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, you called your movie about a psychic, The Gift. Did you grow up thinking that your mother had a gift and that certain talents were just gifts? There were things that you were just given. They came with you, and it was up to you to decide how to use it. But either you had that gift or you didn't. And did you think of yourself as having a gift?
Yes, but to answer the first part of it, I did think that people are born with gifts, absolutely. And I never really questioned all that. I always thought that if you had to try very hard to do something, it wasn't worth doing. And I still feel that to a certain degree. And people always talk about hard work and perseverance, but I think that the people with the creative side of the brain, I think those people are the ones, and it was pretty obvious, they're the ones who are always daydreaming, they usually don't make good grades, they're always like, you know, they always have a bunch of weird things like, you know, well, like I've got phobias and different things like that. Usually just the more eccentric people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then And then there are other people who are very practical, very hardworking, and that kind of thing. That was the world that I never quite understood. And although, I mean, both worlds obviously have are valid and everything, but I just never related to that world. I always thought that you can either do things or you can't do them, you know. And I look at that way. And
you mentioned phobias,
right?
If you don't mind talking about it, what are some of your phobias and how do they affect your gifts? Considering your gifts include writing and acting, do the phobias interfere with those gifts?
Well, the phobias don't necessarily interfere, particularly when I did the movie Bandits. It was helpful because I played a guy with phobias. But, you know, my phobias aren't really that much of a hindrance in my professional life or anything. I have a fear of antique furniture, certain kinds of antique furniture that I can't be around. I can be around.
Wait. not a common fear. What's the problem with antique furniture?
Well, I just get creeped out by it. I can't be around it. And there's a lot of people have this sort of simplistic idea about what that is. They think, well, it's a past life thing, and you know, something weird happened to you at a certain time, and you know, whatever. Which I don't doubt that it's a past life thing. I mean, one friend of mine said maybe I was beaten to death with an antique chair. But
excuse me for laughing.
Oh, no, it's fine. You know, I don't know exactly what it is. It involves food, though. I can't eat around antique furniture. That's the main way it affects me. But anything Asian, I'm okay with. Like, if something is, like, centuries and centuries old, if it's Asian, I'm okay with it. But if it's, like, French or English or Scottish or something like that, I get so creeped out, I can't describe it. Like, my worst nightmare is, like, a castle with velvet draperies and things like that.
So it sounds like a Vincent Price movie to me.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I can't be in a Vincent Price movie. I have an unnatural fear of Benjamin Disraeli's hair.
Strange, but...
Yes, yeah. Strange but true.
Yeah, that's the thing about phobias. They're sometimes really strange. Now, the first movie I saw you in was One False Move, which you co-wrote with Tom Epperson.
Right.
And you play just a really bad killer in this. The first scene is so violent and so... It's a very upsetting first scene.
Yeah.
And quite an introduction to you as an actor.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of movies, particularly in the Quentin Tarantino and post-Tarantino era, have been very ironic about violence.
Right.
And there's, like, not an ounce of irony. This is all for real, very upsetting. Mm-hmm. Why did you want that to be the opening scene of the first movie that you're making by yourself?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily wanted it to be. That's just the movie that we wrote, and that happened to be the one that got made. Tom and I had written other things that we didn't sell and that didn't get made. We, at one point in the 80s, had a three-picture deal at Disney. We wrote a script for them. It never got made. This mm-hmm. one just happened to be the one that got made, and it
right.
got made for very little. And, you know, it wasn't like we got wealthy from it. It was the one, though, that got us critical praise and sort of started us off in the business. So I still credit One False Move as being the movie that got me known, at least in the movie business. Sling Blade's the one that made me into a whatever I am. But One False Move is the one that really got us working in the business. And that first scene, you're right, it's very disturbing, and it's very violent, very, very realistic. The reason we did that, we wanted it to almost look like a documentary where you're really seeing these people being murdered. It was based on a case that we talked to this policeman who told us about this case that happened out in L.A. once. It was kind of loosely based on that, just that part of it, the opening. We wanted it to look that way because... You know, frankly, I think you should be kind of responsible with violence in movies, and always did, really. And if you don't show it for what it really is, I think that is, in a way, irresponsible. And we want you to if I'm going to have violence in a movie, I want it to be violence that's going to make people think, wow, boy, do I never want to be involved in that,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to making it look cool or hip or funny or anything else. I'd rather make it look horrible.
Well, you sure succeeded in that scene. It's a terrific film. As you said, the film you were really noticed for was Sling Blade, in which you played is mentally challenged the right word now? You played a mentally challenged man released from an institution after serving 25 years for killing his mother and her lover. As you made clear when you hosted Saturday Night Live, everyone imitates you doing that part. How did you develop the voice and the character? You wrote the story, in fact, before the movie was made. You had a short film based on the same character, and I think you did him in a one-man show also.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I did was the one-man show. I'd written just the beginning, kind of what was in the short film that I did in the one-man show. I did that long monologue in the beginning there. It's based on life experience is really what it's based on, all of it. I mean, you know, the character of Carl in Sling Blade is based on a couple of different people. And I wasn't even conscious that it was based on them when I was writing it so much. It's like later on, it's like, oh, wow, you know. Matter of fact, my mother pointed out to me that part of that was like this guy that was in Alpine, you know. There was a guy who was kept up back of his family's house, and they, like, fed him sort of like a dog, you know.
Huh.
But the voice came about when I was working on a movie for HBO, and I was in the little sort of, you might call it a dressing room that they'd provided for me. I had just a few lines in the movie. I think I had four lines, and they had peeled my head because the movie took place in the 20s, and I had this really stupid-looking haircut, and I just was in the trailer at lunch, and I was thinking, wow, you know what, I'm just a joke, you know. I mean, I was looking at myself, and I thought, I got four stupid lines on a cable movie here, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere. I was just kind of feeling sorry for myself, really, and I started making faces at myself in the mirror, you know, just to sort of like make it even more exaggerated. It's like, you know, it's almost like pinching a sore.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I made that face, and I started talking in that voice to myself. And it sounds insane. Maybe it is. I don't know. But that's where I came up with that part of the character, the look and the voice. And then I said that monologue to myself in the mirror that day, that whole monologue. I don't know where it came from.
Why don't we hear that monologue?
Okay.
My daddy worked down there at the sawmill, down at the planer mill, for an old man named Dixon. But old man Dixon was a very cruel feller. Didn't treat his employees very well, didn't pay them too much of a wage, didn't pay my daddy too much of a wage. Just barely enough to get by on, I reckon. But I reckon he got by all right. They used to come out, one or the other of them. Usually my mother. Feed me pretty regular. Mm-hmm. So I know he made enough to where I could have mustard and biscuit three or four times a week. Well, old man Dixon, he had a boy. Name was Jesse Dixon. Jesse was really more cruel than his daddy was. He used to make quite a bit of sport of me when I was down there at the schoolhouse. He used to take advantage of little girls there in the neighborhood and all. They used to say that my mother was a very pretty woman. They said that quite a bit from time to time when I'd be down there at the schoolhouse. Well, I reckon you want me to get on with it and tell you what happened, so I reckon I'll tell you. I was sitting out there in the shed one evening, not doing too much of nothing, just kind of staring at the wall and waiting on my mother to come out.
Billy Bob Thornton, in a scene from Sling Blade, which he also wrote and directed. I want to say something about your voice when you're talking. It sometimes reminds me of Jimmy Carter. And sometimes, particularly in certain roles, of Hank Hill from King of the Hill.
That's funny.
Do you think I'm crazy?
No. I don't really hear myself, so I don't know. I mean, I know that my voice has a strange range because I sing very, very deep you know, on certain things. And on other things, I sing really high. Like I, on my second record, I did all the most of the harmonies on the record, and I have a very, very high voice. I can sing, you know, like high harmonies and stuff. As a matter of fact, for my tour in Europe, we're doing a tour at the end of March in Europe, and I've had to hire a female backup singer to sing the parts that, you know, because the other guys in the band don't sing as high as I do. So we hired her to sing the high parts because I got to sing the low parts.
Huh.
But yeah, King of the Hill, I like his voice, Hank Hill. Mike Judge does that. He's a friend of mine. He's really terrific. I love the way he says, Bobby.
What's different about being famous than you imagine? Because most people who want to act or make movies imagine what it would like be like to be famous.
Well, I think probably when you're growing up and you think, hey, one of these days, what if I'm famous or whatever? I think what you probably dream of is you dream of like the Beatles getting off at out at the airport there, and everybody's screaming at you and everything and yelling your name. And then when you get famous, it's like the last thing in the world you want. You know what I mean? It's like maybe at the beginning, it's probably kind of fun in the beginning, you know?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm a little bit embarrassed around people. I'm not sure why, but I'm very embarrassed in public at events. You know, I'm not comfortable with it. And, you know, like these red carpet deals and things like that, I get very embarrassed by that kind of thing. I think it's having all the attention. You know, it's like a surprise birthday party. You know, I'm terrified of that. It's like my worst night. It's my worst nightmare to have like to walk in my house and have like a bunch of people yell surprise and make a big deal and have to open my gifts in front of everybody. I can't. Actually, I've had that happen to me twice in my lifetime. Both times, I almost had a seizure. I kind of feel that way. It's like, you know, when all the attention is on you. It's just, there's something embarrassing about that. And also, I think I have a lot of guilt from, you know, growing up poor and everything and then suddenly having stuff. I feel a little bit guilty about that. And my brother, who died in 1988, I always thought it should have been me. And
how did he die?
He had a heart problem that nobody really knew about. They think maybe he had rheumatic fever as a kid and they didn't know that or something. But he would never go to the doctor. But, I think he also had his time of drug abuse, you know, which I don't think helped him.
Why did you think it should have been you?
Well, I don't know. He was my younger brother. I was the one who had been sick and been near death a couple of times and had real problems with all those other things, you know. I mean, I've been clean of drugs for over 20 years, but I had a really bad time with it, and you know, the worst stuff, you know. And I don't know, he was just a really talented person. I always felt far more talented than me, and he was a sort of genius, my brother. And he was completely honest, which I am these days. I haven't always been. I mean, I mainly have been, but I mean, he was the kind of person who was so honest that, you know, the way I talk about my life these days, you know, I just don't hold anything back. And if I think something about something or someone or whatever, I say it. And my brother always did that. And I think I learned that from him, that you just say it. You say what you believe in. He always did. And I think I felt like I was a weaker person than him and all that. So I think sometimes I feel guilty of my success, about my success.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should have had it.
I want to squeeze in one other scene of yours, and this is from a movie called A Simple Plan. You starred in it. This is about three people who steal money they find at the site of a plane crash. And, you know, they're a little conflicted about it, but they go through with it, and in their attempts to cover their tracks, things go terribly bad. This is a scene where your brother is dropping you off at his house, at your house, and you're wondering how money is going to change your life. Now, you're playing somebody who's kind of mentally slow in this. and who isn't physically attractive, and you know, your glasses are held together by masking tape around the nose piece.
Okay.
Why don't you think somebody will marry me if I'm rich? You don't need money for that. Hank. Hey, come on. What about, what was her name? Carrie Richards? She liked you even though you were broke, Dick. Well, her, yeah. That was a whole different deal. That was her friends. They pitched in $100 all together, and bet her that she wouldn't go study with me for a month. Jesus, Jacob. I thought you guys had a thing. That wasn't that bad. Actually, it was kind of cool. We used to walk around together a lot, you know. Take walks, you know. And we talked about all kind of cool stuff. I held hands with her one time. We were walking around. And my hand sweated so much, I kind of had to let it go. I was nervous, I guess. But it was cool. When the month was over, she, kind of, she'd say hi to me sometimes in the hallway when I'd see her. She didn't have to do that. That was cool of her. God, Hank, you know, I've never even kissed a girl before. But, you know, if being rich will change that, I'm all for it. I don't care. I just want to feel it, you know. I just want to know what people do, you know. I don't care if it's because of the money. Heck, I'm gonna be happy now, right?
Sure you are. We all are.
Yeah, that's right. We all are.
This is a very moving scene in which the character reveals a lot about himself. Could you talk a little bit about doing this scene and not turning it into a big fireworks kind of speech, but playing it really low-key?
You know, first of all, as an actor, you're trying to be realistic. And if you're talking to your brother in a car about something like that, it is going to be low-key. And sometimes, you know, I mean, well, when an actor tries to make a point of something, it's like being at home pretending you're like a rock star in the mirror or something, you know. It's like that's not the way you should do it. You know, you should just kind of talk or do whatever it is, you know. And that scene, though, it was an emotional scene for me. So what I did, really, in that scene, because it was, in a sense, autobiographical. I put a couple of, there were a few lines that I put in there about holding the girl's hand. It was so sweaty. I was embarrassed by it and stuff like that. I had a time when I was in, you know, elementary school and junior high school when it was sort of that way for me. And so that scene was very, very close to me. And as opposed to trying to put anything more into the scene, I was actually trying to hold back because I felt a lot of emotion about it. So I was actually trying to not get emotional. So maybe that's the way it worked, why it worked out that way.
Actor, director, and screenwriter Billy Bob Thornton speaking with Terry Gross in 2002.